Hey, you guys. Good morning, Kurt, alcoholic. What was the time, Liv? What was the time on this? Okay. Well, before we started, a few people asked me about the books behind me, and it's really interesting. I was looking in our book, the big book, page 29. Each individual in the personal story described in his own language from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. And I was thinking about that and I thought, well, I successfully wrecked my life and came to the conclusion I couldn't run it. That's how I established the relationship. On the page before that, it says, here was the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself when he had the extraordinary experience, which we have already told you made him a free man. And we were referencing some books before, and one of them was Varieties of Religious Experience. And what William James says in that one of those books, in some of those chapters, he said, there's a common denominator in every like revelatory experience or spiritual experience. And he said, that's suffering. That's the common denominator. Right. So, how did I establish a relationship with God? And there's kind of two things going on here. There's how did God establish a relationship with me, which would be really the deal. And then how did I establish a relationship with that would be the way the big book lays out a very skillful means of understanding a deeper part of me. I remember Koya said something to me one time. He said, you tell me what you think about yourself and I'll tell you what you think about God. He said, you tell me what you think about God and I'll tell you what you think about yourself. And I thought that was kind of crazy, but I basically wrecked my life. That's basically what happened. And I was sitting in a room and I had a revelatory experience. Some people call it download, where everything made sense. I could just see clearly. And what that seeing clearly revealed was that I wasn't seeing clearly for a long time, but I didn't know that while I wasn't seeing clearly. See, I was came into AA and 1979 got stipulated by the courts. And it was like I just functioned in one paradigm. And the paradigm was the big book talks about it. It says the God of reason. And that was the way I saw the world, was through my thinking. And I came into AA and I had this experience that released me. And I was like, oh my God, this must be what they mean by God. Like I could see how this revelatory experience, it was like I experienced a deeper part of myself. Now, at the time, I didn't know that. All I could articulate to you was it all makes sense. That if you had to say, oh, it all makes sense now. Like I'm an alcoholic. And I'd call somebody and say, hey, I'm an alcoholic. And they go, well, dude, we've known this for 6 years. Everybody around you knows this. But like I couldn't see it. So the terrible dilemma was in a way you could say emptying the cup, letting the air out of the balloon, successfully failing. There's a lot of different ways for that to happen. And the mechanics of how that happened, going through the steps, were really interesting because the first time I went through the steps, I thought I was going to have an experience with the first couple steps. And after going through the steps, what I realized was I'd already had an experience with the first two steps. And what I got was an understanding of the conditions that were met when I went, when I had that experience. So let me explain that. So it says, came to believe in the second step. That looked like to me something I needed to do. And then it changed to something that happened to me. So it was more, rather than instructive, it was descriptive. And when it was descriptive, it looked like the conditions that were met in the first step opened the door to the second step. There was a came to believe experience. There was a revelatory experience, which the book later talked about was your thought life's placed on a higher plane. The great reality is deep within you. The unsuspected inner resource, intuition, intuitive thought, different ways of the great. This awareness is the essence of a spiritual experience, or more religious members call it God consciousness. I mean, they reference it a bunch of different ways. So, God, this is such a deep topic. It can go so deep down a rabbit hole. Well, let me start with this. This is the part where it's really, it says, without knowing it, we've been brought here by a certain kind of faith in we agnostics. And that faith was in the God of reason. So it was kind of telling me the whole time faith was involved all along, said that on page 55. Well, that didn't make sense when I was new, because I thought it was something I had to acquire. And it wasn't. It was that I had deep dependence on my thought process, even as skewed as it was. But I didn't know that. I didn't know that was what I was worshiping, was my intellect. Information. And what I've learned after being around here a while is that's a very limited view of reality. It's a very limited view of me. It's a very limited view of you. That there is a deeper intuitive sense that's totally atrophied. It's asleep in us, or in me, or was. And the process in the big book eliminated the things that blocked me from experiencing that reality within me. So I'll give you a for instance. I was thinking about this when I was down at the beach this morning. We use this analogy a lot. It says, you know, the ocean and the waves, the wave is not part of the ocean. Well, if you'd have said that to me when I was new, I'd have said, well, that's just the stupidest thing you ever said. That's, well, sure, the wave's part of the ocean. And that was the way I saw things. That was the way I saw things separate, see, the wave and the ocean separate. But what I came to understand metaphorically was, and I'm referencing this from me and God, right? Let's just say I'm the wave and God's the ocean, right? What happened was I started to wake up to the fact that the wave is not separate from the ocean. It's not part of the ocean. What the wave is an expression of the ocean. And the content of the wave is water, the same as the ocean. So there is no division. There was this, well, the big book says all-inclusive. Never exclusive or forbidding. All inclusive. So that realization was not at the level of mind. You could say it was at the level of heart. And when I really got that, that existential crisis of unworthiness vanished. It dissipated. Because there wasn't separation. Now, we hear about this. In fact, everybody was asking about this earlier, about different books. You know, like there's different books, you know, I mean, it's obvious behind me, that our big book says, be quick to see where religious people are right. It doesn't say be quick to see that religious people are right. There's a huge difference. There's a difference in this. Where they're right, there's a resonance. There's just a resonance. It doesn't sound like this. It doesn't have that flat. See, and what that intuitive sense starts to be, it hears that. It hears that. You know, in I think it's William James' book, he says, truth identifies itself and doesn't need your help. It's true because it's true. So that's what I'm talking about. So how that's been developed is through being reading, going outside of the, you know, the big book. But what it did was it brought me more closer into the big book. See, all these different things we're being pointed at were all in the big book. I mean, the great reality is deep down within you. Like, it's not out there. But it is out there because you're in it. It's kind of paradoxical, right? There's no separation. So part of this whole journey's been about, and I say this, boy, and I really mean this, successfully failing. You know, this isn't in a right and wrong thing. It's not about doing. I have done this thing totally upside down and backwards. You know, I said something in a meeting we were in. I think Jerry was in it and Mitch. And I said, how do we make all the wrong choices and end up in the right place? See? Like, that's exactly what happened. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's totally paradoxical. But before I ever drank, there was a sense in me. And the sense was something's missing. I'm different. I'm here to tell you today, I was dead on the money. I was dead on the money. There was an intuitive sense that something was missing. And the way that was interpreted took me down a rabbit hole that kind of, you know, well, it was more interpreted by other people, you know. But now I see it as I was totally, totally right on the money. And there's no way I could have known what was missing back then because this thing's very stage specific. And it's a, you know, evolution of maturation towards wholeness. That's what Al-Anon says. It says that this thing is, well, I'll say how Don said it. He said, this is a process, not an event. You will have some big events in this process, but there's the process, and this is life. Life is it's a happening. We want to put everything, well, I want to put everything in it and as a noun, kind of, you know, like. So, came to believe wasn't, so much something I did is something that happened to me. And that was the, really the beginning of it. I mean, that whole collapse of the system. You know, Rohr says it in a book, in one of his books. A lot of these guys say it. It's here. I'll even read it. I hope it's not too much against the form. Until you bottom out and come to the limits of your own fuel supply, there's no reason to switch to a higher octane fuel. But that's what's happening. Why would you? You would not learn to actively draw upon a larger source until your own resources are depleted and revealed as wanting. In fact, you won't even know there's a larger source until your own sources and resources have failed you. Unless there's a person, situation, event, idea, conflict, or relationship that you cannot manage, you'll never find the true manager. So God makes sure several things will come your way that you can't manage on your own. I thought, well, that's very descriptive of what happened. Life surrendered me, right? I didn't surrender. It surrendered me, and You know, I try to do what all of us do here. I try to live from that place on a daily basis, because what I really have, like the big book says, is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of the spiritual condition. Well, the spiritual condition's within. It's not in a meeting. It's not out there. It's here. It's deep within. And it's our nature, which is profound to me. And what's more profound is that I have an immense gratitude for that sacredness that we all have. And, you know, that's all I ever wanted. All I ever wanted was, I didn't want to be the friggin' wave. I was always the wave. I always felt separate. I always felt, you know, like everybody else, you know, somebody else had the handbook. And I really don't have that experience now. I feel like I'm in the right place, which is with you guys this morning, which is really cool. Because, it's interesting. We read it. I mean, you know, in the big book, it's said a bunch of different ways. Like I read that, here's the terrible dilemma in which our friend found himself. Another way it said, hoping against hope. See, my hope wasn't hope. When I came into A, my hope was a form of control and managing unbeknownst to me. I didn't know that though. Because that's the place I always functioned from, was control and managing. And that hoping against hope, my real hope was the collapse of that. My real hope was the collapse of the managing and controlling life. And it was participating in life. So it's being open to, somebody said this the other night. I didn't hear the talk. I heard it was a great talk, though. He said, you say yes to life and let God say no. So what does that mean? You know, I mean, the way Coyas explained it to me was, he said, look, the spiritual life is like, it's walking in the mystery. What's the mystery? Metaphorically, he gave me a picture, and the picture was, it's like you're standing on a spot of light, and you're standing there, and everything is clear where you're standing. And he said, all of a sudden, the spot moves across the room, and you're standing in the dark. He said, you need to walk over to that spot over there and stand there again. He said, it's going to move again. It's going to move again. It's going to move again. He said, that's walking in the mystery. You start to trust that. You start to trust that kind of light and darkness. Like, you know, I sometimes when I need to turn left, I don't get a letter in the mail that says, hey, you need to turn left. I get nudged. I get pushed. See? And if I don't have eyes to see that, like I'm being, like a door closes, you might say. And I push the door, it won't open. I push the door, it won't open. It's like, well, obviously the door's not supposed to open, so go another direction, right? And a lot of this had to do with, you know, 10 and 11. It had to do with how am I going to move through the world? You know, am I going to, my little plans and designs, or am I going to step into this mystery? And this mystery is going to take me places I couldn't even dream to go on. Couldn't even have fathomed it. I ended up in places and still end up in places I never thought I could end up in. So part of that process is like, well, being quick to see where religious people are right. Constructively reviewing my day, right? Rather, I always destructively reviewed my day because I always did it through the lens of guilt and shame. I always did it through the intellect, through right and wrong, through duality. See, I always did it in a sense where failure, success, rather than, you know, and part of that, you know, was cleared up when, you know, Well, the way Don put it to me was, he said, what do you think it means when you say we consider our plans for the day? And I said, well, it means I write down everything I'm going to do. And he said, well, that's not what it means. And I'm like, well, what do you mean that's not what it means? He said, well, that's not what it means. He said, your plans for the day are how you're going to be based on your corrective measures of the night before. So how are you going to be? Not what you're going to do. Because we all know, and I know this, you know, I could write all these 20 things down I got to do, and it never goes that way. There's always life that interjects in between all those plans. Situations come up, you know, unsuspected situations, tragedies, car wrecks, flat tires, you know. So it totally made sense to me, because he said when I constructively, that's how I'm gonna build this way of living. See, I'm gonna make a mistake. It's not guilt or shame, it's a mistake. Welcome to the human condition. Mistake. And then I'm look for the corrective measure from a place, not my head, from this place where it talks about in the book. It says, we ask God's forgiveness. Now, it doesn't say we ask God to forgive us. That's not what it says. It says we ask God's forgiveness. Now, because of that revelatory experience, I know what that forgiveness is. That was the experience of never being judged and unconditional love. That's what God's forgiveness was to me. It was, some people would call it grace. Some people would call it a bunch of different things. So I'm asking God's forgiveness. Why? So I'm asking that because that's where intuitive thought comes from. It comes from that position of neutrality. That might be another way to say it. It comes from that place of peace. You know, we have another friend that says activity can never produce stillness. See? So it was like these corrective measures come from that. And the book even talks about it. It says, we'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us, see? Or the right answers will come. See, it's very descriptive. Like, we talk about this in one of the other meetings. It says you entered the world of the spirit in step 10. So I asked myself, what are they describing? We'll read the promises. Now, it's not that I was ever out of the world of the spirit, but there was no conscious awareness of being in it. You know, the consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. It wasn't a belief system. It started there. You know, I tried to believe stuff I didn't believe for years. But I didn't know I was doing that. I was just trying to do what I thought you told me to do. I would try to believe something I couldn't believe. I tried to believe stuff I was supposed to believe. And I'm telling you, it never worked. It never worked. So this was beyond belief. What I'm talking about here is beyond belief. And some people would say, that's faith. Well, what is that faith? Sometimes I describe it like this. It's a modality of perception that gives reality to this great mystery that we are. So when faith is put in that context, it's great. Now, when faith is put in my thinking, it's kind of, it gets a little wishy-washy. It's a dependence. You know, Heschel, there's a guy, Heschel, that says, you know, he has this great poem about the parting of the veil. We talked about the other night about the Wizard of Oz and Joseph Campbell and some of these guys that are saying, look, there's a story being told about a story being told in every story. You know, like it's like a roadmap. Like all these guys are pointing, they're not talking about it, they're pointing to it, right? So I started to pick up on that. And it was like I said, it was like a resonance. I was like, it drew me in. It pulled me in. It was like here, I could finally hear, really hear. Not like a voice, but an informative, intuitive sense deep within me that was being touched by something outside of me, which was the same thing. So then we developed that by helping other people. I mean, most of us know, shoot, the more we work with people, the more we get, right? It's like, it's so crazy, isn't it? So backwards. It's like the more you try and, you know, try to give this away, the more it just seems to give you more. And so that's part of saying yes, right? That's part of saying we start to see. At first we go, geez, does he have to call right now? I'm in the middle of a movie. You know, that's how it starts. You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, like, come on, you guys. But at a certain point, it's very refreshing. And some of the, I mean, there's guys on here I've met that, you know, I would have never met. I mean, I couldn't have picked the teachers that I've had. There's no way. I couldn't have picked them. It just seems like there was some kind of invisible helping hands the whole time, just kind of pushing me along. I mean, so let me tell you the mechanics of how I went through the second step the first time. This would kind of give you an idea. So in the big book, it talks about, we had these moments of awe and wonder, starlit night, who made all this? So one of the instructions I was given in the very beginning, back in 86, 87, was I want you to look for an experience where you felt complete peace, where everything was okay. And my first response to that statement was, that's never happened to me. And they said, well, I think it has. I just don't think you've looked. And so I was like, okay, it was kind of mechanical, heady. I was like, well, what am I really looking for? I'm not sure what he's talking about. And on the way home, driving from Santa Monica by the beach, I had this experience that came up. And the experience was an experience I had at 12 years old. And I was at my grandmother's. And she had this old estate home that was built in the 1800s in Ohio. And it was on 80 acres. And I had gotten up at like 7 o'clock in the morning. And I'd walked out on, there was this bedrock porch that went all the way around this big house. And I was standing out there and you could see the dew on the grass. It was very quiet. There was no noise. And the morning was fresh. And I remember experiencing a sense of peace. And I thought, oh, that's really weird. I haven't thought of that in a long time, you know. And then I remember my head kicking in and going, oh, yeah, but this is all going to end in a week because you're going back to Texas. See, like my head came online, right? So I thought, wow, that's kind of weird, you know? I haven't thought of that in a long time. So next time I met with him, I said, hey, I said, you know, I think I might have an experience that you're talking about. And he goes, but it's really stupid. You know how we take away from that. And I told him about the experience. He said, yeah, he said, that's what I'm talking about. He said, so, let me ask you a question. He said, if somebody told you that didn't happen, could they convince you that didn't happen to you? And I said, well, no, I know it happened to me. See, this wasn't about a belief system. This was about knowing something. You don't have to believe anything here. You know that happened to you. He said, that's where I want you to start. He said, so when I tell you to get quiet, I want you to go to that place. I want you to go to that place where you experience that peace. And I thought, well, this is stupid. You know, like, this is just the dumbest instructions. But what I read in the big book later on was, a statement that totally defined that. This flimsy reed turns out to be the powerful and loving hand of God. This flimsy reed. And I thought, bingo. Now, Bill had this experience. Bill had it drunk. It's a great writing. It's one of my favorite things in the big book. In fact, I'm going to read it because it's just so profound the way he says it. He talks about Ebby. Sorry about this guy. Where am I? Here we go. Page 9. You know, he's talking about Ebby. He'd come to pass this along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on the still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that pro-offered temperance pledge I'd never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of those church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music. But his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. I mean, just that in itself is so. So what I thought this was when you guys talked about God, I was so far off track. Because I was equating it to an old belief system that I could never believe in, that I was brought up in. And I was trying to connect to that. And I couldn't believe that. And now I totally understand it. I totally understand where they're coming from. Where it started from, but it was all out of context. And I think that had to do with going, you know, doing what the big book said, when it said to be quick to see where religious people are right. Or I'd say be quick to see where science is right. I think they're different dialects of one language. These are all different dialects of one language. What's the language? We call it the language of the heart in AA. I think some of the wisdom traditions, you know, I used to go to this sweat and I'd sit in a sweat lodge and I'd listen to these guys go, "Welcome, Stone Brothers." And they're talking about the rocks coming in. And I was like, what the hell are they talking about? They're talking to rocks, like, you know, this is kind of crazy. But what I came to understand was what they were doing was, they were welcoming a divine expression of God's will as a rock. That we are all divine expressions of that will. As a rock, as a two-legged, as a four-legged, as a winged one, there's no separation. We are all relatives. I couldn't hear the sacredness in what they were talking about because I was listening through my head. And there was a deep reverence for everything that was being used in that sweat lodge. Had a whole different meaning after that. Whole different meaning. Because we're all interconnected to that. We're all not a part of it. We are that. Thy will is being done. It's a happening. And I mean, this is the beauty. This is what we see. This is what we participate in. This is what we, I mean, this is the reverence for life and our fellows. And this is why I think when we see a new guy and we go, oh Lord, I remember, you don't know what you don't know until you know it, you know? It's like, it was so, but there were guys that were like, they knew that I didn't know. And they kind of smiled, you know, they made comments like, oh, keep coming back, you know, which, you know, you don't want to hear that. Or work the steps, or get a sponsor. You know, most of you guys know I drank in 19 years, you know. I managed my life with spiritual principles for 19 years, exhausted that. That was really nice. I needed to get rid of that. Managing your life with spiritual principles is just control. You know, for me, it just was another means of control. It never produced the goods. It never produced the fruit. It never released me from the bondage of self. It never released me from the fear, anxiety. We call it fear, but the mental anxiety. It never released me from the existential crisis of unworthiness. It was either I had to be popular in AA, or I had to worry about this, or I had to worry about that. I was still in the bondage of self, and I didn't know it. I didn't know, because I thought that's the way it is. And I've heard this before, and it's not the way it is. When I hear somebody say, oh, it's always going to be like that, I'm thinking, geez, that's the condition telling you what it's going to be like. The head knows nothing about what spiritual freedom's about. It knows nothing about it. It's always going to be like that. That's the condition telling you how it's going to be. Maybe there's something beyond what that is, you know. And I think that's the real, some people call it emotional sobriety here, you know. And when I say that's the condition, I was identified as the condition. I'm not the condition. I'm not the condition. I don't identify with you at the podium. I identify with the condition that's driving you from the podium. The fear, the anxiety, selfishness. I'm not identifying with you. I'm identifying with the condition that's driving you, the same condition that drives me. There's one, God, I shouldn't go down. I probably shouldn't go on this limb, but I will. When Bill wrote An Emotional Sobriety, you know, he wrote about, he was depressed, you know, he never got that freedom until what, 22, 23 years later. You know, he said at the end of that letter, it says, I've finally been given a quiet place in the sunshine. I just love that. But he says something, and this is just my interpretation, you guys. Some of you guys, it says, suddenly I realized what the matter was. See, that's that revelatory. This is how I'm relating Bill's experience to my experience. Suddenly I realized what the matter was. This is what happened to me when I got released after drinking after 19 years. I suddenly realized what the matter was. I'd been managing my life with spiritual principles for 19 years. They weren't spiritual principles. They were the ego's interpretation of spiritual principles. My basic flaw had always been dependence. No, that's not right. Self's basic flaw had always been dependence. Almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me, no, self, with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams, no, self's perfectionist dreams. And I had fought, no, I didn't fight for them, self did. And when defeat came, so did my, no, it wasn't my depression, it was depression. So I'm reading it from the context of identification with the condition and not identifying as the condition. It was self. we're not this mental condition. We are so much bigger than that. And that's the whole thing about developing this the consciousness of your belief, this awareness. I'm not the condition. I can't be the condition because Clint's got it. And Brittany's got it. And Liv's got it. And it's not me. Just like another way we'd say it is, I'm resentful. No, I'm not resentful. I experience resentment. That's very different. When I say I'm resentful, I'm going, I'm the condition. I'm not the condition. So there's a little separation in that. In the same way there was separation in belief systems versus beyond belief, conscious awareness. This awareness is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Where does this awareness reside? It's an unsuspected inner resource. It's in you. And it's not for me to tell you it's in you. It's for me to discover it in me. That's what it is. It's an experiential thing for me to discover. And when I discovered that, or was allowed access to that, or whatever you want to call it, however you want to put language on it, because you can't, something else showed up. You know, nature abhors a vacuum. It's like it got filled. And it gave me a whole different way to relate to life. And to me, and to you, and to, oh my gosh, everything. This has to be an integrated way of living for me. It can't be a way I read the big book, the way I think. It has to be a way of living for me. When it wasn't, I was totally carried off by business, money, property, prestige, being important to you, being seen a certain way in AA, raining on your parade in AA, all those different ways that, you know, were necessary for me to see it wasn't that. It was a complete negation of that. I needed to do all that stuff to see it wasn't that. I needed to empty the cup. And I'm sure there's more emptying going on because this is a lifelong process. But I don't seem to be causing as much trouble in the world anymore, which is a very nice thing, especially for the people around me. I just have an immense gratitude towards the program. You know, I didn't come in here looking for this. In fact, I didn't come in here looking for you guys. I was sent here by the court system because I, you know, stuck a knife in a guy's back, robbing him in a liquor store when, you know, he told me not to read a magazine. You know, I mean, you're stupid. You know how we do. We just do stupid stuff, right? But I was always, there was that irritable, restless discontentness that the big book talks about. Talks about frothy emotional appeal. God, I had so much to that. Oh, I just lived in that. It was like, it's very frothy, you know? I was like, oh my God, who was I? I didn't know. If I was in the bar and you were a Republican, I was a Republican. If I was in the bar and you were a Democrat, I was a Democrat. If you didn't believe in politics, I didn't believe in politics. I was a chameleon. That's how I fit in the world. That was the coping mechanisms I learned how to deal with. In high school, I was a jock. I played sports. But then when I went out to the parking lot, I hung out with the stoners. You know, it's like I just kind of moved around in the way I could move around so I could fit in this way. That's how I learned how to live. I learned that in AA too. I did the same thing in AA. And, you know, I think that's part of the discovery of this, you know, it's living life. It's, you know, it says none of us like the self-searching. See, I didn't know what that was. That was an unused muscle. I always went to you for the answer. And at some point, I had to quit going to you for the answer. And I had to start really looking within. I had to start asking all the right and wrong questions. Because none of them were right and wrong. They were questions. I needed to go deep within. What do you believe? What's your experience? I had to quit listening to you at a certain point, which brought me closer to you. It's really weird. Didn't separate me from you. It brought me closer to you. So, I'm thinking of this thing a friend of ours says. She said, effort only readies us for grace. Grace can never be willed or planned, only entered. Effort only readies us for grace. It can never be willed or planned, only entered. Like, you know, in Richard Rohr's, one of his books, he says, you're not going to catch the ass by chasing it, but if you don't chase the ass, you won't catch it. It's that whole paradox. The way my first sponsor said it was, he said, you can go sit in a corner and pray for ham and eggs. He said, and you sit there, you probably starve to death. He said, if you go sit in a corner, pray for ham and eggs, and you turn around and put one foot in front of the other, you probably eat ham and eggs. You know, it was like there's stuff to be done. And there's, you know, activity. There's a way of living. It's not like, oh, we get surrendered and we just don't do anything. It's not what, you know, I hope it doesn't come across like that. Part of it is going to the beach in the morning. That's my thing. I'm not going there to surrender. I'm going there because I am surrendered. That's why I'm going there. It's like, that's the deal. It's like, no, that's a present state awareness. And I try to keep that, you know, 24 hours. We have 24 hours. So I don't have to worry about tomorrow, next week, or the next year. We were laughing at dinner. Mitchell and I were at dinner last night. And they're like, you know, you're speaking tomorrow at 8 o'clock in the morning. I said, no, I'm not. I'm speaking at 11 o'clock in the morning. They said, no, you're speaking at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, they usually text me and let me know, you know, the link and everything. I said, I haven't got a text yet. So, and then Susan sent me the flyer at dinner last night at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. I was like, well, it's funny. It provides what you need if you keep close to it. You know, it's like, so we were, you know, right on time. And then I got a text telling me about where the link was and everything. So it's just funny how this thing works, you know? So, I really enjoy this topic. You know, I was thinking about it. I thought, geez, it's really hard to talk on this because it's really hard to talk on. I didn't establish my relationship with God. I don't think I did that. I think God did that. And but there is a cultivation of that relationship that was established and maintaining that. And I think that's the 12 steps in this integrated way of living that allows us to stay in touch with the relationship that was established. Part of that revelatory experience for me was I text a guy when I had that experience in my house. And the text was real. It's really interesting. I text one of the first guys I sponsored. I said, I think I've been found. I didn't know I was lost. That was the text. I think I've been found. I didn't know I was lost. So the solution was very clear on the problem, but the problem couldn't see the solution or the problem. And he goes, where are you? And I said, I'm in my house. And he said, can you meet me? And I said, yeah. And he goes, Borders Books. And so we went to Borders Books, and he looked at me to see if it was me. Because he said, when you drank, you disappeared. He said, you, the guy that we heard about all those years and 19 years, he said, he showed up and you disappeared. And he looked at me, he said, he wanted to see if it was me. And we walked in Borders books. We sat down on the floor. We pulled William James off the shelf and we read a passage in William James. And we both wept like a little baby. And he said, you're back. And that's totally by the grace of God. Totally by the grace of God. So I'm really glad to be here today. And I'm really glad that I shared this morning with you guys. And you guys shared it with me. So thank you very much.